we got the bomb, and that was good, because we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, because the balance of power's maintained that way. Who's next? France got the bomb, but don't you grieve, because they're on our side, I believe. China got the bomb, but have no fears, they can't wipe us out for at least 5 years. Who's next? Then Indonesia claimed that they were gonna get one any day. South Africa wants two, that's right, one for the black and one for the white. Who's next? Egypt's gonna get one too, just to use on you know who. So Israel's getting tense, wants one in self-defense. The Lord's our shepherd, says the psalm, but just in case, we better get a bomb. Who's next? A Luxembourg is next to go, and who knows, maybe Monaco. We'll try to stay serene and calm when Alabama gets the bomb. Who's next? Who's next? Who's next? Who's next?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And if you're just joining us, we're listening to The Psychology Behind Morality and Politics. When it comes to moral judgments, Jonathan Haidt says, we think we are scientists discovering the truth, but actually we are lawyers arguing for positions we arrived at by other means.
It's as though these giant electromagnets got turned on in the 60s, and they've been cranking up ever since, and anything that has the vaguest left-right charge gets pulled to one side, everything gets purified. Psychologically, what we find empirically is that people who identify as conservative tend to like order and predictability, whereas people who identify as liberal, they like variety and diversity. I have one study where we have dots moving around on a screen. Conservatives like the images where the dots are moving around more in lockstep with each other. Liberals like it when it's all chaotic and random.
The surprising psychology behind morality. This is at the heart of social psychologist Jonathan Haidt's research. When it comes to moral judgments, he says, we think we are scientists discovering the truth, but actually we are lawyers arguing for positions we arrived at by other means. In his acclaimed book, The Righteous Mind, he examined the conundrum behind good people divided by religion and politics. Jonathan Haidt explains liberal and conservative not narrowly or necessarily as political affiliations, but as personality types, ways of moving through the world. And his own self-described conservative-hating, religion-hating, secular-liberal instincts have been challenged by his own studies. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Jonathan Haidt is professor of ethical leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. I interviewed him at the invitation of a group called Encounter. It is interested in Jonathan Haidt's research as it navigates an iconically entrenched, bitterly divisive moral conflict of our age, the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. We gathered before an intimate group at the Jewish Community Center of Manhattan. It's exciting to be talking about an important subject in an important place in a room surrounded by books. And actually, where I'd like to start is just with you. You're just a little bit about your background. And I'm curious specifically whether you would find traces or roots of, you know, not just your interest in morality, but in a sense your passion for morality in the religious or spiritual background of your childhood.
Well, my religious and spiritual background is sort of stereotypical for my generation, born in 1963 to parents who were first generation. All four of my grandparents were born in Russia and Poland, came to New York, worked in the garment industry, loved Roosevelt, union organizers, My parents raised me in Scarsdale, New York. I was very assimilated. I have a strong sense of being Jewish as my culture, but not as really as a religion. As a kid who always loved science and when I first read the Bible in college, the Old Testament, I was horrified when I read the whole thing. And so I went through the phase that many young scientific types go through. I'm the sort of person who would have been a new atheist if I hadn't taken a very different turn in my own research.
So you studied philosophy in college, is that right? And then it seems to me that you made a move, a shift that our culture is actually making, which is that great questions or this great inquiry about the human condition, which once was reserved for philosophers and theologians, has now moved onto frontiers where we are learning to understand our minds. And in understanding our minds, understanding ourselves in a whole new way.
That's right. That's what most excites me is I think we're all interested in our origins. Everybody is interested in origin stories. Where do we come from? Why are we this way? And when I first read, actually Richard Dawkins, when I first read The Selfish Gene and I began to learn about evolution, I felt, oh my God, it all makes so much sense. This is why we are the way we are. And I remember when I was in London and Westminster Abbey, I guess it was, wherever Darwin is buried, and you know, in England, they have the graves right there in the church and people walk over them. And I was like, no, don't walk on Darwin's grave. So I felt as though studying the social sciences and evolution, I feel like we are really beginning to reconstruct our ancestor and origin story. It's very, very exciting. And I find it gives me a lot of compassion for us as a species because, you know, a lot of people love to shake their heads and say, oh my God, things are so terrible and we're such monsters. But I have very, very low expectations. My standard is, you know, we're animals. We're like chimpanzees that actually figured out how to get along amazingly well and not hurt each other, not hit each other. I mean, it's amazing how peaceful we are, actually.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think, just what you just said, that I feel like we're coming to a place where we can have a vocabulary of considering ourselves as a species.
Yes.
Right? Which is kind of a new evolutionary phase. And, you know, having said that, that you started thinking about these things seriously with Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, the field you are part of, which is new, which has developed in your lifetime, in our lifetime, is positive psychology, the study of human flourishing. Which it takes off into new directions.
That's right. So that would be, I guess, part of the story is psychology has tended to be a very negative field in that it's especially focused on problems.
Pathologies and neurosis.
Violence, drug addiction, racism, all those sorts of things. And those are, of course, extremely important to study. We've made a lot of progress on them. But in the 1990s, Martin Seligman, a psychologist at Penn, said when he was president of the American Psychological Association, well, what about the positive side of life? Most people are doing pretty well. And when they go to the bookstore, all they have on offer are books by Deepak Chopra. So we should be having psychologists doing research on the positive side of life. And I started doing research because I study morality and how it's based in the emotions. So I'd been studying the emotions of disgust and anger and shame. And then I started to think, well, what's the opposite of disgust? And I started, you know, what do you feel when you see somebody do something beautiful or uplifting? Right. And it felt to me as though there's such an emotion, but there wasn't a word for it, at least not in the psychological language. I mean, you can say uplifted or touched or moved. And I came across a wonderful passage in Thomas Jefferson. I just arrived at the University of Virginia, and he is he's everywhere. I felt like I worked for the man. It was wonderful. But he describes why it's so important to read good fiction, because the effect that beautiful deeds, beautifully explained, can have on you. He said it does not elevate his sentiments, does not dilate the breast and elevate the sentiments, you know, sort of feeling of opening, as much as any example in real history can furnish. And he talked about how it makes us more open, and then new things are possible.
Mm-hmm. It seems like he almost had an intuition of what's being learned in social psychology now.
Oh, Jefferson was fantastic, yes.
Right.
Jefferson and Ben Franklin. We had a few founders who were great psychologists.
Yeah. So let's just talk about your kind of basic premises. So one of them, we kind of have had this illusion that we were primarily rational creatures. And your first premise would be that moral judgment is based mostly on intuitions rather than conscious reasoning. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's the one way you said this. When it comes to moral judgments, we think we're scientists discovering the truth, but actually we're lawyers arguing for positions we arrived at by other means.
Exactly. And if you don't believe that about yourself, just note how true it is of everybody else, and then think they think that of you.
So a second premise is that there's more to morality than harm and fairness. So explain what that means.
So in psychology, pretty much everybody who studies morality is politically liberal.
Really? Is that really true?
Yeah. Yeah. There, I've found one social psychologist who is a conservative. He's a friend of mine. I've not found another. And that's a whole separate discussion about the terrible things that happen. I mean, we're talking about polarization here. What happens when the academy itself becomes polarized so that all the liberals are in the academy and all the conservatives are in think tanks in Washington?
Right.
So it really interferes with our ability to think and to study.
But it makes for great cable television.
Well, that's right? Yeah, that's right.
It produces
right.
the talking heads.
Yeah, that's right. And no progress.
Yeah.
So when I entered the field in 1987, it was dominated by people who were pretty far left. And so morality was basically defined as altruism, and it was especially altruism towards poor victims. So ideally, helping poor kids in Africa, that is the best thing you could possibly do. So all the research was about compassion and about fairness and justice, and that's it. And when I took a course in cultural psychology from a wonderful anthropologist named Alan Fiske, and we read all these books about these ethnographies of morality in other cultures, and people care a lot about food and food taboos and menstruating women and the body and all these things that I had read 15 years before in the Old Testament. And I realized, oh my God, almost every culture on earth has this very broad conception of morality, in which it's not just about, am I hurting you and treating you fairly.
Right, a whole array of things that come under that category of moral.
Exactly. Issues of purity and authority and group loyalty. And the interesting puzzle, which is now being solved, is how did the West get so weird? And by weird, I'm not using that as an insult. Weird stands for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. Whenever you have a society that has those five attributes, the moral domain shrinks down, individualism rises up, people get more analytical. There's a massive set of changes that happen. And everybody in this room, I dare say, is to some extent weird.
Okay. A third premise is that morality binds and blinds.
This is the one I'm most excited about. This is the one that I feel unlocks so many of our hardest problems, particularly the ones we're here to talk about tonight. So if you go with me that morality is part of human nature, that it is something that evolved in us as our primate ancestors became cultural creatures that lived in larger groups, then these groups competed with each other, and the groups that were able to hang together and cooperate are the ones that succeeded and became our ancestors. So if you are with me that morality, just like the love of our children or the sense of humor or language or all these things about us, if you're with me on that, then you begin to see morality not just as, am I nice to you? You begin to see morality as this amazing ability that binds groups together in groups that are larger than kinship. Probably none of you here are siblings, but we all have common concerns. You form organizations. We're all members of dozens of organizations. We cooperate so brilliantly. And that's because we have this moral psychology that binds us together. It's most effective when we have a sacred value, something that we all worship or circle around. So it's clearest in religions, where the sacred value is literally God or the Torah or whatever. But you'll see it in any political group, too. So on the left nowadays, just in the last year or two, it's become overwhelmingly marriage equality and rising income inequality. You know, on the right, it's long been the family and America.
Those are the things we define as moral issues.
That's right.
Primary
That's
moral
right.
issues.
But keep your eye on the sacred values. Okay. That really helps you understand, and we'll come back to that mm-hmm. here, I'm sure.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today with social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. Moral foundations theory, which he helped create, suggests that human beings are born with moral receptors. Just as our taste buds organically incline us to like and dislike certain tastes and textures, our minds come equipped to feel pleasure or displeasure at patterns in the social world. But Jonathan Haidt does describe five primary moral foundations that are held across individuals and cultures. People who are liberal and conservative, he says, value two of these in common, compassion and fairness. But conservatives simultaneously juggle three other moral values of loyalty, authority, and sanctity. So, I mean, clearly there's political life resonance, and clearly for all of us living in America right now in 2014, there's political resonance. But talk about that. Talk about how you look at the collapse of, I think, civility and an ability to solve problems and to speak across difference in terms of the science that you're doing. One thing that you've talked about is the importance of disagreeing constructively. I don't know, do you know, well, so you say very interesting things also about how it is harder for liberals to understand conservatives, or that liberals need to try harder to understand conservatives, then conservatives would have to try to understand liberals. And I think that's probably a provocative statement, possibly in this room.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I mean, what do you know that informs that statement?
Very, very brief background. So one of my main areas of research, my colleagues and I call it moral foundations theory, is about these different, almost like taste buds of the moral sense. So everybody values compassion and fairness, whether you're liberal or conservative, everybody. But then there are these three others, loyalty versus betrayal, authority versus subversion, and sanctity versus degradation. And what we find is that conservatives give relatively high marks to all five of those. They value all of those, whereas liberals reject those last three. That's like the foundations of racism and exclusiveness and group loyalty, that's terrible. In other words, liberals build their moral matrix, their moral world, on these two foundations primarily. And in one study that I did with my former graduate student, Jesse Graham, we asked liberals and conservatives to fill out our main surveys pretending to be the other, and also as themselves for different people. What we found is that conservatives and moderates were very accurate at filling it out as though they were liberals, but liberals were not accurate filling it out as though they were conservatives, because they just couldn't get their mind into the idea that authority is somehow related to morality. They think it's just oppression. So that's one reason why there's a difficulty, an asymmetric difficulty. The other reason is that the media tends to be liberal, as the academic world is in Hollywood. So you cannot grow up in this country without being exposed to lots and lots of liberal ideas. But it wasn't until I was about 40 that I happened to pull a book off a shelf that said conservatism on that I was ever exposed to conservative ideas. And I'm well-educated, and I'd never encountered conservative ideas. So there's a real asymmetry in access to the other side's ideas.
And you very much value the way conservatives, and I think, you know, this would be conservatives politically or religiously, you know, the conservative people and minds among us, in an important and necessary way, remind us of the, what did you say, the binding foundations of society. That's important to you that liberals remember.
That's right. That was really the eye-opener for me. I was always very liberal growing up. I really hated Ronald Reagan, and my first political memory is having a poster of Richard Nixon, and my friend and I completely defaced it. We thought it was so funny because, you know, we hated him in our seven-year-old minds. But in doing this research and coming to see that liberals and conservatives each have a piece of the puzzle, each are really perceptive about certain moral values, about the needs of what it takes to have a humane society. And if you let liberals run everything, they tend to burn up social capital. But conservatives tend to focus more on building up social structures that actually do allow us to flourish in some ways. You do need order. You do need some restrictions. You do need some boundaries.
So in some ways, what you're learning could be experienced to be reductionist, right? I mean, it suggests that much of what we think we know and do and the control we think that we have and the rationality behind our behavior is illusory. But I also very much hear you saying that this knowledge itself is a form of power, right? That we can know this and use that knowledge.
Yes, that's right. I love reductionism in that you look at how, oh my God, these things we do, you can explain them by biology and evolution. That's reductionism. But I always pair it with emergentism. We form these complex webs, and out of them emerge social institutions. Out of them emerges historical trends. So we are not prisoners of our genes or of our childhoods. The choices we make now will change what happens to us tomorrow. So I certainly want to pair that, the reductionism and the emergentism. And at every point in history, is a crossroads. And we can point to people in recent history who blew it, who made bad decisions that made it even tougher for us now. But it's never hopeless. So I do think that if we can all get a better grasp of this moral psychology, we can turn it to our advantage.
And you are not a religious person, but you, as a social psychologist, very much value see a value
Absolutely.
In religion,
yep.
In society.
Yeah, and that makes me not unique. There are other social scientists who do, but it makes me in the minority. And I used to be very hostile to religion. And then in doing this research on moral psychology and coming to see conservative perspectives and then looking at the social science evidence on the effects of religion, well, it's pretty clear. I mean, it's a little mixed. There are some mixed findings. But the lit reviews generally find that religion in the United States, and it may not be true in other countries, but in the United States, where we have a competitive marketplace and religions compete for adherence, they're really nice and warm and open, and they create moral communities that encourage people to not just focus on themselves.
Right.
And so a wonderful book, American Grace by Putnam and Campbell, is the ultimate authority on this. What they find is that it doesn't matter what religion you are, and it doesn't matter what you believe. If you're a part of a religious community, then on average, you're a better citizen, you give more to charity. Religion does bring out the good in people. Now, secular people can be perfectly good too, but mm-hmm. on average, they give less and they give less of their time. So I'd like to think that I simply, as a secular atheist scientist, followed the evidence and it showed me that I was wrong in thinking that religion was evil.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook. Coming up next, George H.W. Bush, President of the United States, announces the commencement of the bombing of Iraq in the Gulf War in 1990. Approximately 20 to 35,000 military people were killed. Over 1,000 Kuwaiti civilians died, and approximately 3,664 Iraqi civilians died.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. Ground forces are not engaged. This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor. Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed. Its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined. This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait. Now, the 28 countries with forces in the Gulf area have exhausted all reasonable efforts to reach a peaceful resolution, have no choice but to drive Saddam from Kuwait by force. We will not fail. As I report to you, air attacks are underway against military targets in Iraq. We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential. We will also destroy his chemical weapons facilities. Much of Saddam's artillery and tanks will be destroyed. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal. Initial reports from General Schwarzkopf are that our operations are proceeding according to plan. Our objectives are clear. Saddam Hussein's forces will leave Kuwait. The legitimate government of Kuwait will be restored to its rightful place, and Kuwait will once again be free. Iraq will eventually comply with all relevant United Nations resolutions, and then, when peace is restored, it is our hope that Iraq will live as a peaceful and cooperative member of the family of nations, thus enhancing the security and stability of the Gulf. Some may ask, why act now? Why not wait? The answer is clear. The world could wait no longer. Sanctions, though having some effect, showed no signs of accomplishing their objective. Sanctions were tried for well over 5 months, and we and our allies concluded that sanctions alone would not force Saddam from Kuwait. While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation, no threat to his own. He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities, and among those maimed and murdered, innocent children. While the world waited, Saddam sought to add to to the chemical weapons arsenal he now possesses, an infinitely more dangerous weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear weapon. And while the world waited, while the world talked peace and withdrawal, Saddam Hussein dug in and moved massive forces into Kuwait. While the world waited, while Saddam stalled, more damage was being done to the fragile economies of the Third World, the emerging democracies of Eastern Europe, to the entire world, including to our own economy. The United States, together with the United Nations, exhausted every means at our disposal to bring this crisis to a peaceful end. However, Saddam clearly felt that by stalling and threatening and defying the United Nations, he could weaken the forces arrayed against him. While the world waited, Saddam Hussein met every overture of peace with open contempt. While the world prayed for peace, Saddam prepared for war. I had hoped that when the United States Congress, in historic debate, took its resolute action, Saddam would realize he could not prevail and would move out of Kuwait in accord with the United Nations resolutions. He did not do that. Instead, he remained intransigent, certain that time was on his side. Saddam was warned over and over again to comply with the will of the United Nations, leave Kuwait or be driven out. Saddam has arrogantly rejected all warnings. Instead, he tried to make this a dispute between Iraq and the United States of America. Well, he failed. Tonight, 28 nations, countries from five continents, Europe and Asia, Africa and the Arab League, have forces in the Gulf area standing shoulder to shoulder against Saddam Hussein. These countries had hoped the use of force could be avoided. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.